Thank God for chapter 4. Let's look at just a little bit of it just before we go to lunch.
You know, Dr. Jung told Roland that ideas, emotions, and attitudes, that's what we're going to be looking at now. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which are the guiding force of the lives of these people, are suddenly cast to one side. And certainly the ideas, emotions, and attitudes that I had toward God were that of a 7 or 8 year old boy. I couldn't accept it then. I couldn't accept it later. I couldn't accept it when I got here. And I can't accept it today. Because I need new ideas and emotions and attitudes about this. New information is what I'm trying to say. This chapter, we agnostic. Just the word agnostic means something to me. Gnostic means knowledge. You put the ag in front of it, means without. Those are us who are without knowledge. And that was me. And the knowledge that I did have was not good. And Bill had the same experiences that we did. When Ebby presented him with a solution, he was aghast at that solution. Some of us are aghast at that solution also. And Bill said that whenever they talked to me of a God personal to me, he said, my mind became irritated and snapped shut against such theories. And certainly that's the way that I did. Later on in the book, it says to us that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. The spiritual malady. The understanding of God of my understanding. When that is straightened out, we're straightened out mentally and physically. In this chapter here, we agnostic is an attempt to do that. And as Father Bill Wilson, some of you know Father Bill, said to us many, many times, and I love it, he said that this chapter is not put here to teach me that there's any particular type of religion or type of God. He said this chapter is simply put here so that I might read and question and wonder and get some ideas, emotions, and attitudes, new ones, and open up my mind to a point that God might prove to me there's a God. Now, with that understanding of this chapter, it means more sense, makes more sense to me and becomes extremely valuable in my life.
In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you can find that you cannot quit entirely.
Because of the obsession.
Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take.
Because of the allergy.
You are probably alcoholic. God, isn't that simple? Isn't that simple? You see how people like to expand on things? They took the two questions out of the big book, and some years later they made a little pamphlet that had 10 questions in it. And that wasn't enough. They made another one that had 20 questions in it. Hell, I think we're up to 44 today, aren't we?
Yeah.
Thank God Bill or Abby didn't have the 44 questions with him when he walked into Bill's kitchen. He'd have said, Bill, has alcohol been bothering your reputation? Hadn't had a reputation in years. Then he would have said, Bill, has alcohol been interfering with your sex life? Is anything like I was, he hadn't had any of that in a long time either.
There's a statement in the 44 questions that says, do you drink alone? Well, think about it. If I'm buying, yes, and if you're buying, no.
We had an old friend that used to live in Tyler, Texas. His name was Wino Joe. I've always felt sorry for everybody in AA that didn't get to meet Wino Joe. He was a real character. He's dead now. But Wino Joe had made up his own list to ask yourself to see if you're alcoholic. And the first question on his list was, has the roof of your mouth ever been sunburned?
While drinking.
He said, if it has, you're probably alcoholic. I think the second question was, have you ever been arrested for drunk driving from the back seat of somebody else's car? The third one I love was, have you ever been arrested for public drunk while in jail? He had a real list of them. We only need these two. I use them all the time. People come to me today, they say, Charlie, you think I might be alcoholic? I say, I have no idea. Let me ask you a couple questions. Have you been able to quit drinking entirely, left on your own resources? If they're a real alcoholic, they've got to say no. And then I say, do you have any control over the amount you take after you've once started drinking? If they're a real alcoholic, they've got to say no. And then I say, well, you're probably an alcoholic. And that's about as simple as you can make it. Now, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. You know, we are very unique people. We number amongst a few people in the world today who suffer from a twofold illness that can only be overcome by a spiritual experience. We also number amongst a few people in the world today who have a terminal illness that we can come out of it in better shape than we were when we went into it, if we can have this spiritual experience. We are unique people. Now, to one who feels he's an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death,
step one,
or to live on a spiritual basis,
step two,
are not always easy alternatives to face. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up, something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics, and our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. And I had to stop right here and see what is my belief as far as this God thing is concerned. And today we find there's only one of three ways that you can believe as far as God's concerned. One way is to be an atheist. Now, an atheist says there is no God. Therefore, they have no power greater than human power to turn to. The atheist would have to stand on their own two feet, run their own show. And I said, Charlie, are you an atheist? I said, no. I've always believed in some kind of God, so I'm not an atheist. I said, well, then maybe you're an agnostic. So I had to go to the dictionary and look that word up. And like Joe said, the word agnostic means without knowledge. An agnostic believes that there is a God. But since we've never tried to use God's power in our life, we've run our own show, stood on our own two feet. We've never received God's power, so we don't know that God exists. We believe in some kind of God, but we don't really know whether that's true or not. And I think that's what most of us are when we get here. Most of us get here with some belief in a God, but we have never turned to that God, and we've been running our own show and standing on our own two feet and doing our own thing. Even though we believed in God, we acted as if we did not believe in them. An agnostic is one without knowledge of God, just belief. Now, if you're an atheist or an agnostic, then the question becomes, how do you become a true believer in God? A true believer is one that knows that God exists. Don't believe it, knows it. A true believer is one who has experienced God's power in their life, and God has given them whatever they need to have a successful life. I don't think any of us get here as a true believer, because if we knew God and experienced God's power, then we wouldn't have to come to AA to solve our problem. Most of us come here as agnostics. Now, whether we be atheist or agnostic, the question becomes, how do you get from that stage to the stage of one who is a true believer and can receive God's power in our life? Page 45, first paragraph. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. You know, if we wasn't powerless, we wouldn't be here, would we? Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. It doesn't say which will enable you to solve it, or will help you solve it. It says the main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, and then that power will solve the problem. And I find, interestingly enough, from page 45 on in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't talk about alcohol anymore. We're through with that. We talk about one thing and one thing only. If you are powerless, whether you be atheist or agnostic, if you are powerless, how do you find the power? And if you can find the power, then the power will solve the problem.
Okay, we're going to go to page 46 in the chapter We Agnostics. And the book says that, yes, we have agnostic temperament and have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and effect the contact with Him. You know, my sponsor at that time, George, saw that I had a real problem with his idea about God, and he asked me about it, and I said, yes, I am. I'm having a hard time trying to understand. And he said, well, I've noticed that. He said, why don't you do something that helped him and maybe would help me? He said, why don't you go home tonight and write down on a piece of paper what you would like God to be, laying aside all that stuff you think that you know, and just write down on a piece of paper what you would like God to be. And so I went home that night, and I wrote down some things. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. It's up to you. And I wrote down some things I wanted God to be, and I showed them to George. And he looked at them, and he said, well, that's good, Joe. So you can begin with that. See, I didn't know you could do that. And down in the South, you go to hell for making up your own God. True. You had to believe as they believed. You had to have faith in what they had faith in. If you didn't, you was going to go to hell. But George gave me permission, and I needed that permission, to sit down and to say, I would like God to be these things. And he said, that's good. You can start with that, and you can begin with that. And so that's exactly what I did.
Where it says, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and effect of contact with Him. Now, here's where we can cast aside the first old idea. The old idea that I had was that you had to believe as they believed. And they had me convinced that if you didn't believe as they believe, there's no way that you're going to get anything good when it comes to God. So I was real pleased to find out that I can cast aside that old idea, and then I can have my own conception of God. And like we said yesterday or last night, you know, I find that I've never had any problem with my own conception of anything. And you let me start believing in God the way I want to, then I've got an entirely different idea. An old idea cast aside, replaced with a new idea. Begins right here.
And the book says, as soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard a turn for those who seek Him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. See, all I had to quit doing was saying, no, there's not, no, and start seeking. Start saying, yes, maybe, and I started seeking. I said, George, you mean I need to find God? And he said, George, God's not lost. I said, didn't take me long to figure out who was lost, but I mean, he said, it's just like the book says, it's in the seeking, it's not in the finding. All I had to do was seek. You know, and that's all this book is asking me to do, and this chapter is asking me to seek with an open mind and to wonder and to think. And eventually God will disclose Himself to me. And that's exactly what's happened.
I was told as a kid growing up that the way to God was a very narrow path, that if you strayed off either side of it, you were going to get in a hell of a shape. I was taught that God was very, very exclusive, that only those that believed as they believed would be able to make any contact with God. Those were old ideas. Now my book says we found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. Old ideas cast aside, replaced with some new ideas, beginning to find this power greater than human power by changing of the old ideas to new ideas. Page 47.
So when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you.
Prejudice is nothing more than old ideas. Do not let any old ideas you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you.
So at the start, this is all that we needed to commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood Him. And then afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. But that was growth, but if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. And that was a beginning for me. I needed a beginning place, and that's where I started. Now we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe?
The agnostic has always believed in some kind of God.
Or am I even willing to believe?
The atheist can become willing to believe that there's some kind of God.
That there's a power greater than myself. And as soon as a man can say that he does believe,
the agnostic,
or is willing to believe,
the atheist,
we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. And again, the asterisk, please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experiences. Again, they want to make real sure that we understand what they mean by those terms.
He says it's been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Asterisk, bottom of the page, referring to the spiritual experience. So the wonderfully effective spiritual structure we're building is the spiritual experience or the spiritual awakening. And he said the cornerstone of that is to believe or to be willing to believe that there's a power greater than human power. We referred to that once before. The foundation of that structure was step one, which is willingness. Now then he tells us the cornerstone of that structure, step two, believing. So we've already put two stones in place. If we can say we're willing, and yes, we believe, or we are willing to believe, either one of the two. And he said that was great news for us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. And there has always been one of my great problems with this God thing. Faith indicates surety. Faith indicates knowledge. Faith indicates after-the-fact information. And one of my problems has always been the minister would say, son, all you got to do is have faith and everything will be all right. Well, I never could have faith because I had no knowledge of God. I didn't know for sure that God would do anything for me. The best I can possibly do is to start with belief. And there's a big difference between belief and faith. Believe me, there is. A good example of that, let's say I moved into this area here, and 3 or 4 months later I've got a problem with my automobile. I don't know a good mechanic anywhere in this area. But we'll say that you've lived here for a long time. And I assume you'll know somebody, so I come to you and I say, can you recommend a good mechanic for me? And you say, well, sure. Take your car over there to John. He'll do you a good job, and he'll charge you a reasonable price. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. The best I can do with that information is if I believe it's strong enough, I'll take my car over there to John. And sure enough, he does a good job. He charges me a reasonable price. When I leave there, I know that he will do that. When I went there, I believed that he would do that. Now, 6 months from now, I have trouble with my car again. I don't ask you or anybody else where to take it. I take it right back to John. This time, I took it on faith, took it on knowledge. You can't start with faith. You can only start with belief. And that's all we have to do. We either have to believe, or we become willing to believe that there's a power greater than we are, and we're on the road to spiritual recovery. We don't have to know anything. Thank God step two says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It didn't say we came to know. Didn't say we had faith in that. We just came to believe. And I came to believe based upon what I've read in the book and what you told me, that there's a power greater than I am can restore me to sanity. I didn't know that. I just believed that. Now, if I know that the beginning of this thing, the finding of the power, is just to believe or be willing to believe, then the next thing I'm going to have to know is what procedure am I going to follow in order to find that power. Let's go over to page 51 for just a moment.
First paragraph. It says, "This world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reasons. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas." And I used to wonder why it is that we today have cellular phones and TVs and automobiles and airplanes, and why those people 100 years or 200 years ago or 500 years ago didn't have or admit those things. I thought we were just smarter than they were. But come to find out, they had the same intellect that we did. Intellect means the capacity to learn. They had the same capacity to learn as we do. But the only one thing that kept them in those dark ages, so to speak, it was superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. That's why I say I need an open mind more today than I ever needed an open mind. And I think we as a society have done that. Right here in the northeast corner of our United States some 225 years ago or so, people came over here for religious freedom. They wanted to practice a religion as they saw, as they understood it. And as long as you agreed basically with their religion and you practiced your religion somewhat like they did, you were okay. But if you had any thoughts or ideas that were different, and you expressed those thoughts and ideas openly, and they didn't agree with what they had and what they agreed with, they would burn you at the stake as a witch. Right here in America, they did that. So if you had any ideas like that, you certainly didn't express them. You kept them to yourself. So superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas kept people from growing. And I think we as a country has gotten over that today. Our minds are open to many, many things.
He said some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth preposterous. Now, I think Columbus is one of the greatest examples of what you can do based upon belief if you're willing to change your belief. Some 500 years ago, most of what they called the civilized world was situated around the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, the western shores of Europe. They had found a place called the East Indies. And in the East Indies, you could get gold, silk, and spices, lots of goody-goodies. But it took literally years to get to the East Indies. So they were trying to find a new trade route to the East Indies. And somebody said, "Is there any possibility that we could sail a ship there?" And they said, "Well, no, dummy. Don't you know you can only sail to the northeast end of the Mediterranean Sea? And then you have to go by land, camelback, horseback, footback, however they traveled." And that trick took literally years to do. And they said, "Well, what would happen if we sailed any other direction?" And they said, "Well, idiot, don't you know if you sail out there, you're going to sail off the edge of this sucker?" You see, everybody in those days thought the world was flat. And they assumed if you sailed out there, you would sail off the edge of it. Now, I don't know why they believed that. I assume some people sailed out there, didn't come back, and they thought they had sailed off the edge of it. Now, Joe said the other day, wouldn't it be great if the world was flat? We could take all this environmental junk, just take it out there and go and push her overboard and be done with it. Now, here comes Columbus. And we believe that Columbus had to be an alcoholic. Because if you're going to believe differently than the world and everybody in it, and you're going to stand there and express that belief, you're going to have to be tougher than hell to do it. Because many times, if you express a belief different than whatever everybody else believes, they would burn you at the stake or hang you from a tree or cut your head off or something. And Columbus was tough enough and bullheaded enough to be able to stand there. And he said, "I believe that the world is round. I do not believe it's flat." What? Then he made one of the most drunk statements the world has ever heard. He said, I believe we can get east by sailing west. Now, if that isn't drunk thinking, I don't know what is. Many of his mannerisms indicated he's alcoholic. When he left, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. When he got back, he didn't even know where he had been. But what really made him an alcoholic is a woman financed the whole trip for him.
She did that twice.
Columbus followed a little formula.
You want to write down these key words in this formula.
He followed a little formula that the world has always known. That if you want to change anything at all, there are certain things that have to take place. And the first thing you have to do in order to change anything is to be willing to do so. Circumstances are what make us willing. Trying to find the new trade route to the East Indies is what made him willing to change. The second thing you have to do to change anything is to believe you can do so. You know, he said, I believe that the world is round, it's not flat. I believe you can get east by sailing west. But his belief didn't do him any good either, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that belief. Some days, weeks, months, years later, he did the third thing. He made a decision. He said, by golly, I'm going to go find out whether this thing is round or flat. Can you really get east by sailing west? But his decision didn't do him any good either, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that decision. Some days, weeks, months, years later, he did the next thing you have to do. He started taking action. And the first thing he did, he went to the King of Portugal to get the money. But the King of Portugal, being a very astute businessman, said, there's no way I'm going to let you have this money, because you'll sail out there and sail right off the edge of this sucker and I'll lose it all. That's why he ended up with the Queen of Spain. Sweet-talked her out of the money on the promise that he would bring back gold, silk, spices, and the goody-goodies of life. She gave him the money. He bought 3 ships. He put provisions in those 3 ships. He put crew members in those 3 ships. And they began to go east by sailing west. Sailing west day after day after day. Now, we don't know for sure, but we have a suspicion that on that first trip, he hired a special sailor, put him on the bow of the lead ship at night with a lantern, whispered in his ear, said, I believe this thing is round, but if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler so we can get turned around in time. Now, after having sailing straight west for several days, they got results. They found land on the other side, which was the result of the action that they had taken. Now, we know that he thought it was the East Indies. It wasn't. It was the West Indies. But he had proven to himself, the world is not flat. It is round. You will not sail off the edge of it. Turned right around, came right back to Europe. Went right back to the Queen of Spain. And she said, Columbus, where's the gold, silk, and spices you promised you would bring me? And he said, sweetheart, I'm sorry, but I didn't find any. But he said, tell you what I'll do. If you refinance me, I'll go back.
Trust me, honey, please.
And this time I'll find it. And she refinanced him. And he got some more ships, more provisions, more crew members. They began to go east by sailing west with one big difference. The second trip, he didn't hire the special sailor. Put him on the bow of the lead ship at night. This time he went back on faith. He went back on knowledge. The first time he went back on belief. You can't start with faith. The only thing you can do is start with belief, make the decision, take the action, get the results, and then you'll have faith. Now, I would love to sit here and tell you today, and the decision will do us no good unless we take the action. And that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. As the result of the action, then we will get results too. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we now have faith, we now have knowledge, we no longer believe. You see, I don't believe today that God will restore me to sanity. I know that He will because He has done so. Now, those of us who have been restored to sanity and we have the faith, then we can go back and help the next newcomer come to believe. They can make a decision, and we can take them by the hand and walk with them through the action steps. Then they will get results. They'll have a spiritual awakening, and then they'll know, and then they can go help the next newcomer come to believe. Now, there's only one thing you and I can't do for the newcomer. We cannot make them willing. That's a job they have to work on themselves. Now, how does an alcoholic become willing to change? Very simple. Drinking lots of whiskey. I hear people come to AA and they say, I've been working on step one for 3 years in AA. And I said, no, you haven't. You don't work on step one in AA. You work on step one out there. And when you've drunk enough of that whiskey, you just can't stand it any longer. Then you become willing to change. Then we can begin to help you by helping you come to believe, decide, act, and have a spiritual awakening. Same formula that the world has always used to change the status of anything. Now, if I know I need the power, and if I know the beginning of the finding of the power is just to believe, if I know the procedure to follow to find the power, then I only need to know one more thing. Where am I going to find that power? And I think we get here just as confused about where God is as we were ever confused about anything else. As a kid growing up, somewhere I got a picture in my mind. Now, I don't know whether I dreamed it or saw it. But in my mind, when I was thinking about God, He was a tall, elderly gentleman. Stood on a cloud up in the sky. Long, flowing white robes on. Long, white hair. Golden halo around his head, and sun rays shooting out of that halo, and a big stick in his right hand. Now, I don't know whether I saw that or whether I dreamed it, but one of the reasons I thought God was there is because every time the minister talked about God, he always pointed up there, so I knew he had to be up there somewhere. But then what really confused me, I noticed every time the minister wanted to talk to God, he always looked down here. He points up, hell, no wonder we get confused as kids about where God is. And I looked and I looked and I looked and I looked, and I never could find God because I never did know where He was. And it took the big book Alcoholics Anonymous to tell me just exactly where I'm going to find Him. Page 55.
You know, many years ago, I was working for, not working, but I was involved in a halfway house in Tulsa, and I was heavily involved, and there was this young man there who'd asked me to be his sponsor, and he said, well, what do you think I ought to do? I said, well, it'd be probably a good idea if you had a job, you know, to start somewhere here. And he said, well, easy for you to say, I don't have any car, and I can't get back and forth with no money. Can't even ride the bus. And I said, well, I'll take you around and help you find a job. And then if you find a job, I'll take you back and forth till you can get a couple of paychecks, and then you can buy a car or do whatever you need to do. He said, fine. So I'm taking him back and forth to work. And one morning he told me a story that really helped me a lot. And he said, and this is the way the story goes. He said, there was the three wise men of the East, he said, and they took from man the crown of life, the thing that would make us the happiest, and took it away from them. And they said, well, now we took it away from them, what are we going to do with it? I said, well, one of the guys said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take it to the highest, highest crevice on the face of the earth and the highest, highest mountain, and we'll hide it up there, and he'll never be able to find it. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt and they'll search and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what, we'll take it to the deepest, deepest crevice of the deepest ocean and hide it there, and they'll never think about looking for it there. But he said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt and they'll search and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll hide it within himself, and he'll never think about looking for it there.
Page 55, first paragraph.
He said, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves, a miraculous demonstration of the power in human lives, are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but He was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found. It was so with us. So we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. Now, with this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. A God of your own understanding is sure to come to you with an open mind.
You know, it seems as though all human beings are born with some basic knowledge deep down inside themselves, probably lying at a subconscious level. And that basic knowledge seems to be able to tell us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. It seems to be able to tell us how we should live and how we shouldn't live. And I'm sure a lot of people would like to refer to that as just plain old common sense. I think others might want to call it innate intelligence. Some might want to call it the conscience. And others might want to call it the soul. And I don't think it really makes any difference what we call it, as long as we recognize the fact that it's there. And if you're anything like I am, as far back as I can remember, I've always been aware of that knowledge. There used to be times I would be getting ready to do something, and some voice somewhere from within inside me would say, "Charlie, I don't believe you ought to be doing this." And I wouldn't pay a bit of attention to it. I'd go right ahead and do it, and I'd just get in one hell of a mess. And that same little voice would say, "See, I told you not to do it in the first place." Now, if that's true, and if that's God, then what that means to me today, if God dwells within me, then I've got my own personal God. I don't worry anymore about whether he's the God of the Baptist Church or not. I don't worry whether he's the God of the Catholic Church, the Hebrew religion, or anybody else's God. If he dwells within me, then he's my own personal God, and he and I can come together in very simple, very understandable terms. This is one of the greatest pieces of information that I have ever learned, is that I can have my own God, and he dwells within me, and my knowledge comes from him, and through him, I'll be able to find that power. Now then, am I ready to make a decision? You betcha. When he was a God of justice, when he was hellfire and brimstone, I wasn't ready to make that decision. But throughout this chapter, my concept of God has changed entirely, and I'm beginning to believe he just might be a kind and a loving God. And just maybe he'll start doing some good things for me, not hellfire and brimstone. And now I'm ready to make a decision. And I don't think it's by accident that the very next chapter is entitled, How It Works. And I think we get here just as confused about where God is as we were ever confused about anything else. As a kid growing up, somewhere I got a picture in my mind. Now, I don't know whether I dreamed it or saw it. But in my mind, when I was thinking about God, he was a tall, elderly gentleman. Stood on a cloud up in the sky. Long, flowing white robes on. Long, white hair. Golden halo around his head. And sun rays shooting out of that halo. And a big stick in his right hand. Now, I don't know whether I saw that or whether I dreamed it, but one of the reasons I thought God was there is because every time the minister talked about God, he always pointed up there, so I knew he had to be up there somewhere. But then what really confused me, I noticed every time the minister wanted to talk to God, he always looked down here. He points up. Hell, no wonder we get confused as kids about where God is. And I looked and I looked and I looked and I looked, and I never could find God, because I never did know where he was. And it took the big book Alcoholics Anonymous to tell me just exactly where I'm going to find him. Page 55.
You know, many years ago I was working for, not working, but I was involved in a halfway house in Tulsa, and I was heavily involved, and there was this young man there who'd asked me to be his sponsor, and he said, "Well, what do you think I ought to do?" I said, "Well, it'd be probably a good idea if you had a job, you know, to start somewhere here." And he said, "Well, easy for you to say. I don't have any car, and I can't get back and forth with no money. can't even ride the bus. And I said, well, I'll take you around and help you find a job. And if you find a job, I'll take you back and forth till you can get a couple of paychecks, and then you can buy a car or do whatever you need to do. He said, fine. So I'm taking him back and forth to work. And one morning he told me a story that really helped me a lot. And he said, and this is the way the story goes. He said, there was the three wise men of the East, he said, and they took from man the crown of life, the thing that would make us the happiest, and took it away from him. And they said, well, now we took it away from him, what are we going to do with it? He said, well, one of the guys said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take it to the highest crevice on the face of the earth and the highest mountain, and we'll hide it up there, and he'll never be able to find it. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt, and they'll search, and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what, we'll take it to the deepest crevice of the deepest ocean and hide it there, and they'll never think about looking for it there. But he said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt, and they'll search, and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll hide it within himself, and he'll never think about looking for it there.
Page 55, first paragraph.
Said, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves, a miraculous demonstration of the power in human lives, are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found. It was so with us. So we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. Now with this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. A God of your own understanding is sure to come to you with an open mind.
Now, it seems as though all human beings are born with some basic knowledge deep down inside themselves, probably lying at a subconscious level. And that basic knowledge seems to be able to tell us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. It seems to be able to tell us how we should live and how we shouldn't live. And I'm sure a lot of people would like to refer to that as just plain old common sense. I think others might want to call it innate intelligence. Some might want to call it the conscience, and others might want to call it the soul. And I don't think it really makes any difference what we call it, as long as we recognize the fact that it's there. And if you're anything like I am, as far back as I can remember, I've always been aware of that knowledge. There used to be times I would be getting ready to do something, and some voice somewhere from within inside me would say, Charlie, I don't believe you ought to be doing this. And I wouldn't pay a bit of attention to it. I'd go right ahead and do it, and I'd just get in one hell of a mess. And that same little voice would say, see, I told you not to do it in the first place. Now, if that's true, and if that's God, then what that means to me today, if God dwells within me, then I've got my own personal God. I don't worry anymore about whether he's the God of the Baptist church or not. I don't worry whether he's the God of the Catholic church, the Hebrew religion, or anybody else's God. If he dwells within me, then he's my own personal God. And he and I can come together in very simple, very understandable terms. This is one of the greatest pieces of information that I have ever learned, is I can have my own God, and he dwells within me, and my knowledge comes from him, and through him, I'll be able to find that power. Now then, am I ready to make a decision? You betcha. When he was a God of justice, when he was hellfire and brimstone, I wasn't ready to make that decision. But throughout this chapter, my concept of God has changed entirely, and I'm beginning to believe he just might be a kind and a loving God. And just maybe he'll start doing some good things for me, not hellfire and brimstone. And now I'm ready to make a decision. And I don't think it's by accident that the very next chapter is entitled, How It Works.
You know, back on page 45, it said the main object of this book was to enable me to find a power greater than myself, which would solve my problem. And Bill's going to sit down here now, and he's going to write some of the best spiritual information the world's ever seen, a little formula called, or proposals, he called them, 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can just see Bill there with a problem that he has. You know, we've got Protestants in AA, and we've got Catholics in AA, and we've got Jewish people in AA. We've got a sprinkling of Muslims in AA. We've got some Buddhists coming to AA at that time. And how are you going to write a set of steps or proposals that's not going to offend some of these people? Quite a chore for a guy like Bill, or anybody, to tell you the truth. The Oxford groups were coming from first century Christianity. They had those four absolutes, and they were really, really strong. They wouldn't give you any slack at all. They were more interested in the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. Bill was interested in the spirit of these things rather than the letter of them. That's why it's a spiritual program. So Bill had one gigantic problem here, try to write these steps in order to, in such a manner that it wouldn't offend anybody, and he accomplished that through the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
These four absolutes that the Oxford group had said you were to practice: absolute love, absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness. And these alcoholics were having a hell of a time being absolute anything except drunks, you know. And they said, Bill, we need to get rid of that kind of stuff. Also, they had made their own little steps, six of them, which came from the Oxford group tenets. And Bill could see loopholes in these steps that the alcoholic mind was slipping through. And he knew that they were going to have more strength. And he knew they were going to have to be expanded. But he didn't know how far. And in trying to satisfy that bunch, in trying to satisfy the people from all different religions, and in trying to satisfy those who didn't want God in here, Bill had a terrible time with it. By that time, AA had really divided into, you might say, three factions. In Akron, where Dr. Bob was, they didn't have any problem with God. Dr. Bob was a highly religious man. He used the Bible. He insisted everybody he worked with use it too. God was no problem there. But the New York City people were an entirely different breed of cat. They really didn't want anything to do with God if they could avoid it. They would have preferred a book dealing with the mind rather than spirituality, period. And there was finally a third faction that had said, well, let's talk about God, but let's don't talk about him too much. Let's come down somewhere in the middle of this thing. So Bill's trying to satisfy them all. And he said he tried and he tried and he tried and he tried to get started on chapter 5. This is going to be the directions on how to recover. And he said, I simply could not do it. And he said, one night while in bed, leaning against the pillow behind his back, leaning against the headboard, pad and pencil in hand, trying to start chapter 5, he said, I finally just gave up. And said, I put down the pad and the pencil and said, I prayed and asked God for help and direction. And he said, I meditated for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And he said, then after a while, I reached over and picked up the pad and pencil. And he said, it felt as if the pencil had a mind of its own as it raced across the pages. In less than 30 minutes, he had written How It Works, one of the greatest pieces of spiritual information the world has ever seen. After he had written it, he went back and numbered these proposals, and he found out there was 12. He didn't set out to write 12. He went back and numbered them, and there was 12 of them there. Now, almost immediately after having done that, somebody knocked on the door. One of the guys in a New York City group had one of his sponsees with him. They knew that Bill stayed up late working on the book anyhow, so they had come by to see Bill on the way home. Bill could hardly wait to show this to this older member. Look at the new 12 steps. And the older member said, what in the hell is this? Said, Jesus, said we only had 10 commandments, and now you got 12. And he said, 6 has been sufficient for everything up till now. And he said, I don't like it at all. And the fight was on. And they fought, and Lois finally came in and gave him a cup of coffee and settled him down. Then Bill presented this how it works to the other members, and that's when the crap really hit the fan. Because they began to say to Bill, this sounds too much like the Oxford Group absolutes. You're going to have to get some of that stuff out of there. And they said, Bill, you're trying to give directions to people, and you don't have the right to tell anybody what they have to do. And Bill this, and Bill that, and Bill this, and Bill that. And they almost destroyed not only the book project, but the little fellowship in its entirety. Now, Joe's going to read how it works from the original manuscript, which most of you probably heard before. And if he reads through there, I think you'll be able to see the differences between what Bill wrote that night and what the fellowship forced him to change in order to have what we have today. Let's go through it for just a moment and see the differences.
Can you imagine what kind of fight you would have if you left here today, went back to your group, you had 12 sets when you left, but now you had 24? Be a little fighting going on, wouldn't it? That's what Bill was up to. And this is how it works, the original manuscript. He said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions.
Not our suggestions, our directions.
Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. Now, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there's one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection care with complete abandon. Mm-hmm. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. One, admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him.
Over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Remember that. We'll refer to it later on.
Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God and to ourselves and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly, on our knees, ask him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now you may exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Now, our description of the alcoholic.
That's the doctor's opinion. Bill's story, some of it in chapter 2 and 3.
The chapter 2, the agnostic.
Chapter 4.
And our personal adventures before and after.
Bill's story and those in the back of the book.
Have been designed to sell you 3 pertinent ideas. Well, Bill was a salesman, you know. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step 1.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Step 2.
C, that God can and will.
The rest of step 2.
Now, if you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point, or else just throw it away. So you can see that Bill didn't, his intention was not just a set of suggestions. He was going to give real directions on how to work the steps and when to work the steps. And going to give us precise, specifically, clear-cut directions on how to do that. And he was very adamant about it. But the crap hit the fan, and they asked him, and they made him through the argument to make some changes in this original How It Works. And so today's How It Works that we have in the book are the changes that was forced upon Bill. You know, and Bill said that he would compromise with him in this area, but he made a deal with him. And I can imagine through all the arguments that they had up to this point, back and forth of this program, the kind of arguments that they had. They were almost ready to disband and ruin the little fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. So Bill made a little compromise. He said, I would from now on, I'll make these changes, but from now on, I will complete the rest of this book, or else you can do it. Well, they didn't want to complete the rest of the book. They wanted Bill to continue to do that. So they agreed to let Bill continue to write the rest of the book without much interference on their part.
He got almost sealed, Bill, when he wrote this and gave it to them, and they began to fight and argue over it, and they began to tell him he's going to have to change it. And remember, Bill's stubborn and bullheaded, just like the rest of us. And he said, no, I'm not going to change this. And they said, well, Bill, you are. Don't you remember, it's not your book, it's our book. That's the deal we made to begin with. He said, that doesn't make any difference. He said, I'm not going to change this part of the book. And they said, well, you are going to change it. And he said, what you guys don't realize is these aren't my words anyhow. He said, these are God's words. They came after prayer and meditation. And they said, we don't give a damn whose words they are. It's our book, and you're going to change it. And finally, Bill realized that if he didn't compromise, they would destroy this project and maybe the whole fellowship. And there was a non-alcoholic psychiatrist around in those days, and he made some suggestions. He said, why don't you change it from directions to suggestions? You'll still get your meaning across, and probably more people would accept it. And he said, well, you're saying you. He said, don't do that. Don't tell them what they have to do. Change that to we. Say, this is what we had to do. And you'll get your message across, and more people would probably accept it. And he said, well, you're saying must, change that to ought, and it will be more acceptable. Now, Bill very, very reluctantly made those changes. Now, today we don't know. If they hadn't made the changes, if they'd left it like it was originally, maybe instead of 2 million worldwide, we might have 10 million. But also, if they hadn't made the changes, instead of 2 million worldwide, we might only have 10,000. Who knows? Nobody knows. We just know this is the history behind this particular part of the book. Bill was cunning, baffling, and powerful also. Because he said, okay, I'm going to compromise with you. But you're going to have to compromise with me. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, I'm tired. I fought with you all. I'm going to fight. He said, if you want me to finish the book, then you give me the authority to do so. And if you don't want to give me the authority, then you finish the book. Well, they didn't want to give him that authority, but they didn't want to finish the book either. So they very reluctantly agreed to that. Now, what Bill knew that they didn't know is 2 pages later, he's going to put directions and you and must right back in the book. He's had it in the book all the way up to How It Works. They jerked it out, and then he puts it back, and that ruins some of the continuity of the book. But now that we see what happened, it makes more sense. The other thing that is so apparent is when he says back here about the 3 pertinent ideas, if I can find it again. I don't trust my memory that good anymore. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. He's talking about the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters and the stories in the back of the book. And if we've been sold on those three pertinent ideas, A, that we're alcoholic and cannot manage our own life, then we're through with step one. If we've come to believe that no human power can relieve our alcoholism and that God can and will, then we're through with step two. Now, the very next statement says, if you are convinced, you are now at step three. You see, the fallacy in trying to start somebody in chapter five is it starts with step three. And it's hard to start with step three unless you've got one and two behind you. People come to us today and they say, well, how do you work steps one and two? And our answer is you don't. They are not working steps. There's no action involved here. These are conclusions of the mind that we draw based upon information presented to us in the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters. I've always been powerless over alcohol. My life has been unmanageable because of that. I just did not know that, nor did I know why, until I read the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters. There's always been a power greater than I am could restore me to sanity. I just did not believe that he would, nor did I understand the insanity until I read the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters. Now, if I can say to myself today, you betcha, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, I'm through with step one. If I can say to myself today, I have come to believe there's a power greater than I am can restore me to sanity, I'm through with step two. And now then, I'm ready to look at step three. So now I might make a decision.
Being convinced we were at step three, we haven't took step three yet, we were just there, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Well, just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Well, that's a very good question, isn't it? What does step three mean? Well, we're going to make a decision, that's part of it. To do what? To turn our will, and what is our will? Our will is our thinking, and our life is our actions. We're going to make a decision to turn our will and our life over the care and direction, that's what the step used to say, to God as we understand Him. Our will is our thinking, our life is our actions, and we're going to make a decision to let God direct our thinking and direct our life in step three. Haven't done that yet, but we're getting willing to do that.
I've always heard a lot of people say one of the most misunderstood steps in the big book is step four, and I'll agree with that. But I don't think step four is any more misunderstood than step three is. I hear people today say, I've been in AA about 5 years. My life's still all screwed up, and I don't understand why, because I turned it over to God 3 years ago when I took step three. No, we don't turn anything over to God in step three. We make a decision to do something in step three. And the decision itself implies we're going to have to take some further action to carry it out. You know, one of the greatest examples I can think of is probably 4, 5, 6 years ago now. Barbara and I made a decision to come to Los Angeles, California and visit some of our relatives. But we didn't do anything to carry that decision out. And sure enough, we didn't get to Los Angeles that year either. Second year in a row, we made a decision to come to Los Angeles and visit our relatives. Again, we didn't do anything to carry it out, and we didn't get to California either. Third year in a row, we made that decision. Only this time, it was a little different. This time, I took the car down and had it serviced. Barbara packed the clothes and a little food, and we got in our car and we drove from our home to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then we drove to Oklahoma City. Then we drove to Amarillo, Texas. Then we drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Then we drove to Flagstaff, Arizona. Then we drove to Barstow, California. Then we drove to San Bernardino. And then we drove to Los Angeles. And by golly, one day we ended up visiting our relatives in Los Angeles. Not because we made a decision, but because we took the action necessary to carry out that decision. Now, what is it we're deciding to do? Well, we're making a decision to turn our will over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. What is our will? Well, our will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. Our will is nothing more than our mind. Our will is nothing more than this thing up here that tells us what to do and what not to do. You know, a good example of the word will, tying it together with mind. And let's say that some of us are beginning to approach the end of our lives, which a few of us in here are. And we've gathered up a few material things and we become concerned with what's going to happen to them when we pass on. We'll go down and sit down with an attorney. And we'll tell that attorney what we want done with these things. I want this to be my spouse's. This is to go to my daughter. I want this to be my son, and etc. Now that attorney will take my thinking coming from my mind that day, write it down in legal terms on a piece of paper. I'll sign it, the attorney will sign it, and we'll put it in a safe. Now a year or two or three later, sure enough, I kick the bucket. And if my family's like most of them, they're going to call the undertaker and say, come and get him. Get him ready and let's get him out that cemetery about as soon as we can. And a couple of days later, they all gather out at the cemetery. They have me suspended over a hole in the ground. They're all standing around that hole. Somebody says a few words and gives a little prayer.